This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Rand. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has confirmed an evacuation is underway of civilians at a steel plant in the bombed-out city of Mariupol. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has more.
The United Nations says the long-awaited evacuation of people from a steel plant in the Ukrainian city of Mariupol is finally underway. UN humanitarian spokesman Saviano Abreu told the Associated Press the evacuation from the Azovstal steel plant was being done with the International Committee for the Red Cross and in coordination with Ukrainian and Russian officials. On Friday, Yulia Fedusyuk, the wife of an Azov regiment fighter, told the AP the soldiers in the steel plant should be allowed to evacuate as well.
Of soldiers matter too, and we can't talk only about civils, and we are hoping that we can rescue the soldiers too.
Up to 1,000 civilians and an estimated 2,000 Ukrainian fighters were believed to be hunkered down beneath the Soviet-era steel plant. I'm Mike Gracia.
U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi pledged continued U.S. support for Ukraine when she met President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kiev, revealing the unannounced visit the day after, while Moscow said it had struck at weapons supplied by Western nations in the country's south, with fighting stretching along a broad front in southern and eastern Ukraine. Some civilians have reached the relative safety of a temporary camp in Russian-held territory after being evacuated from the bombed-out ruins of the steelworks in the city of Mariupol. The strategic eastern port city on the Azov Sea has endured the most destructive siege of the war, with Pope Francis, in implicit criticism of Russia, telling thousands of people about it in St. Peter's Square on Sunday. This is VOA News. Police fired tear gas to push back black-clad anarchists who ransacked business premises in the French capital Paris on Sunday during May Day protests against the policies of newly re-elected President Emmanuel Macron. Thousands of people joined May Day marches across France in which they called for salary increases and for Macron to drop his plan to raise the retirement age. Most were peaceful, but violence broke out in one part of Paris where windows were broken and garbage bins set on fire. Police said activists had even attacked firemen trying to put out fires. Police responded by firing tear gas. About 250 rallies were organized in Paris and other cities. Italy and Greece ease COVID-19 restrictions as they prepare for the summer tourism season. AP correspondent Naomi Shane has more.
The popular European summer destinations prepare for peak season after two economically difficult years. Greek aviation authorities announced that proof of vaccination and a negative test are no longer needed for international domestic flights. In Italy, similar health passes are no longer required when entering restaurants and other venues. But public health officials stress that the pandemic is still not over and ask citizens to remain diligent. Italy, which was once the epicenter of Europe's outbreak, is still reporting around 700 cases and more than 100 deaths per day. I'm Naomi Shannon.
In the U.S., New York's Broadway drops its proof of vaccination requirement, instead leaving that decision up to individual theaters. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The Broadway League says beginning in May, the owners and operators of all 41 Broadway theaters will no longer be required to check for vaccination status, but can do that if they choose. However, the league is extending the mask requirement at least through the end of May, and says it will revisit that policy at the end of this month. Several shows, including Macbeth, Plaza Suite, and The Music Man, have canceled performances in recent months after cast members tested positive for COVID. Julie Walker, New York.
Recapping our top story, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has confirmed an evacuation is underway of civilians at a steel plant in the bombed-out city of Mariupol. It comes after U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi pledged continued U.S. support for Ukraine when she met President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kiev, revealing the unannounced visit the day after, while Moscow said it had struck at weapons supplied by Western nations in the country's south. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News. We'll be right back.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We, the Fathers of Africa, are ready for this leadership. This war. But it takes more than the private sector for this to happen. We need the public sector, government, political leaders. We have created an enabling environment that will orchestrate this, an enabling environment that allows this to happen.
Anthony Elumelu, a prominent Nigerian businessman and philanthropist, empowers over 7,000 young African entrepreneurs.
Donors should basically support the initial years of ABBA. But that's not the longer term plan. So at the beginning, there will be donor funding, but quickly, AMA will have to be independent and financially viable.
More than 20 African countries ratify the establishment of the African Medicines Agency, or AMA.
As we speak, there are no Tigrayan forces remaining after. Even if humanitarian delivery shouldn't be conditioned as you know it, presence of our forces in Afar is no more excuse for the region to block delivery of humanitarian aid.
And Ethiopian federal authorities dismiss a claim by Tigrayan rebels that their forces are out of the neighboring Afar region. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Anthony Elumelu is a prominent Nigerian businessman and philanthropist. He is the chairman of Hears Holdings, Transcorp, and founder of the Tony Elumelu Foundation. The foundation has several initiatives and programs which has empowered over 7,520 entrepreneurs in 54 African countries. Officials say the future of the foundation hinges on the provision of robust and multifaceted support to entrepreneurs in Africa. Elumelu is currently visiting the U.S. for the first time in a couple of years. He met with senior Biden officials, U.S. business executives, and others seeking to provide linkages and opportunities to create jobs for African youth. For more about his meetings here in Washington, I reached Tony Elumelu via Skype.
I've been very emphatic in my position that the economic transformation of Africa lies in the hands of entrepreneurs, especially our young ones, and their ideas. Yet, in terms of job creation and opportunities for our youth, Africa lags dismally behind. Youth unemployment is a waste of talent and a betrayal of a generation. It feeds extremism and insecurity, and I believe that we should all be concerned about this, pool resources together to address this. At the Tony Elumelu Foundation, when we started with a sum of $100 million, the ambition was to identify 1,000 young African men and women from across 54 African countries and support them with seed capital of $5,000 each, non-refundable grant, train them 12 weeks, provide an appointment for them, and hopefully help working together, all of us, to move Africa out of poverty.
You are here in Washington and you're meeting some officials of the Biden administration. What do you seek with them? Are you seeking partnership between your foundation and some of your colleagues that you've met here in Washington about your objective of employing Africans?
For me, it's not just about partnership with the Tony Elumelu Foundation. It's broader than that. First is, let's imagine the nature of relationship between America and Africa. Two is to promote investment and attract investment to the continent. Three is to let the world know, and America in particular, that young Africans are energetic, intelligent, brilliant, want to succeed, but they need some form of support to get there. And letting them know also that there are institutions on the continent by the Tony Elumelu Foundation that have practiced this new way of giving in Africa and that have attained significant impact.
Let me ask you about your thoughts regarding the links between entrepreneurship and peace building in Africa. Following the recent upheavals or the slide of democracy and pretty much violence on the continent.
There's a strong link between entrepreneurship, peace, and conflict. My position is that you can't have peace where there is poverty. You can't have peace where people are starving. You can't have peace where there's youth unemployment. So for peace to reign, we need to address the fundamentals. We need to deal with the issue of education, we need to deal with the issue of healthcare delivery, we need to deal with the issue of economic opportunity and hope. People take to embrace extremism when they do not have economic hope. People who are comfortable or who see a future will not take to extremism. So for us to talk of sustainable peace on the continent, we need to fix the basics. And I believe that that is what brings enduring democracy. And that is what we all need.
So what do you think about what African leaders and the international community can do to harness the potential of the continent's private sector to move Africa toward a better future? And is it even realistic?
It's not utopia. It's realistic. And I'm the proponent of Afro-capitalism, which is a call on the private sector to lead, to show the way in the economic transformation, development, economic prosperity of the continent by investing long-term in critical sectors that help to transform our economy. And we, the private sector in Africa, are ready for this leadership, this role. But it takes more than the private sector for this to happen. We need the public sector, the government, political leaders. They will create the enabling environment that will orchestrate this, enabling environment that will allow this to happen. What is happening so far? Are we encouraged from what we see? Well, certainly better than what it used to be, but there's still room for significant improvement.
Anthony Elumelu is a prominent Nigerian businessman and philanthropist. He spoke with me from here in Washington. More than 20 African countries have ratified the establishment of the African Medicines Agency, or AMA. It is a specialized health organization of the African Union that seeks to enable the production of quality medicines to be sold to African countries. It will also facilitate efficient and credible regulatory reviews of new products, as well as increase the supply of quality standard medicines. The Center for Global Development, or CDG, recently held an online conference that brought together stakeholders and funders. They discussed how the AMA could secure broad and sustainable support for functional structures and maximum impact. For more about the major takeaways from the recent dialogue about the AMA, I reached Javier Guzman. He is the co-author of the article, Striking While the Iron is Hot, Setting the African Medicines Agency Up for Success.
The African Medicines Agency is the opportunity for all the African Union member states to really incorporate regulatory harmonization, incorporate reliance, efficiency, effectiveness, to strengthen the quality of medicines and health technologies in the African country. And basically, AMA can help Africa leapfrog from low existing levels of regulatory capacity to a regional harmonized approach. So it is very, very promising. But at the moment, you know, it is the moment of truth.
Javier, you recently wrote a paper about what the African Medicine Agency, or AMA, can do. But what do you think this organization can do to build and leverage the experience of existing initiatives and structures?
That's a very important point in terms of how do we get started and what are the key priorities. And the first thing to say is, you know, AMA must clearly establish its priorities. And that basically means what regulatory functions. And within these what regulatory functions, there should be a push for low-hanging fruit, a push to demonstrate value. And the key one, for instance, is marketing authorization. So if AMA is able to reduce the time, improve the efficiency of the marketing authorization process, that means products will get quicker to African citizens and products will be quality assured. So that is one key element. A second element is building on existing initiatives on, for instance, approving clinical trials or building on other regional approaches that have worked globally to do, for instance, good manufacturing practice inspections and avoid recreating the wheel where, you know, every country does the same process to actually achieve the same result. So I guess the point is the priority should be decided now, and AMA should build from existing efforts and should basically concentrate on low-hanging fruit to demonstrate value.
Javier, you just mentioned value addition. How can the African Medicine Agency demonstrate its impact as well as part of the process to attract additional support?
At the moment, there isn't sufficient regulatory capacity in African countries. So very few agencies are recognized as functional. So the first thing is how, you know, AMA can basically support countries to make regulatory decisions in absence of regulatory capacity. And that basically means relying on decisions made regionally. So that is one. How decisions can be made regionally and how can AMA support countries with low regulatory capacity. Two, it is basically reducing the time for medicines, for essential medicines to get to African citizens, to be approved for African markets. And that basically means not just speed, but also quality. It needs to be quality assured. So basically that is a sign of, you know, regulatory capacity, the ability to register products of quality quickly and, you know, in a very harmonized manner. So the manufacturers, you know, those who produce the medicines don't need to do the same similar process in 52 African countries, but it's, you know, something that is done in a more efficient manner. And of course, the third point is basically AMA can really support countries to build capacity. And build capacity, you know, learning from what has worked in the continent. So we've seen examples like the East African community where, you know, they've been able to harmonize regionally within EAC, you know, the procedures, the processes, the, you know, so manufacturers can just do one application by registering multiple countries. So I think there's a lot that can be done, and I just outlined some of the key elements to go ahead with.
Now, Javier, initiatives like this, the African Medicine Agency or AMA, are laudable, the prospects appear lofty, but soon run into financial headwinds. How can this organization move differently to secure sustainable financing?
There needs to be recognition that donors should actually support not just AMA, but the regulatory ecosystem in Africa. So donors should basically support the initial years of AMA, but that's not the longer term plan. So at the beginning there will be donor funding, but quickly AMA will have to be independent and financially viable.
Javier Guzman is the co-author of the article Striking While the Iron is Hot, Setting the African Medicines Agency Up for Success. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Ethiopian federal authorities are dismissing a claim by Tigrayan rebels that their forces have pulled out of the neighboring Afar region. A spokesman for the Tigray People's Liberation Front this week said the rebels had withdrawn their fighters so the federal government would allow much-needed aid to reach the Tigray region. For VOA, Henry Wilkins reports from Hague, Ethiopia.
4 days after the announcement by the TPLF that it had pulled its forces out of Afar, The federal government does not appear to be increasing the frequency of humanitarian convoys to Tigray, as some had hoped. Earlier today, the Ethiopian Ministry of Foreign Affairs gave a press briefing which stated TPLF forces have only withdrawn from a few areas of Eribti, Berehale, and Abala town, while maintaining control of the surrounding areas of Abala affecting the aid corridor. It is still in control of other wards of Afar and the Amhara region. The Afar Regional Communications Office did not respond to a request for comment. It has not yet been possible to verify if Tigrayan forces are still present in Afar. Yohannes Abraham, a spokesperson for the TPLF, reiterated the claim to VOA that TPLF forces have pulled out of Afar.
The pullout was done per the previous plan to withdraw in a step-by-step fashion. Contrary to the false narrations, as usual, alluded by the Ethiopian regime and its subsidiaries in Afar and elsewhere, as we speak, there are no Tigrayan forces remained in Afar. Even if humanitarian delivery shouldn't be conditioned as you know it, presence of our forces in Afar is no more excuse for the region to block delivery of humanitarian aid.
William Davison is an analyst for the Brussels-based International Crisis Group. He notes that the Ethiopian federal government had indicated the TPLF's pullout from Afar might result in more aid reaching Tigray.
Throughout the federal government's communication following its humanitarian truce announcement, it's made reference to the Tigray forces' presence in Amhara and Afar regions, almost suggesting that it's almost a condition for the increased delivery of aid for Tigray forces to vacate those areas. It seems that the conditions inside Tigray are absolutely desperate. And now we will see whether this actually leads to something approaching unrestricted humanitarian access.
Ethiopian analyst Kiram Tedesi points out, however, that even if the Ethiopian federal government gives the go-ahead for aid to enter Tigray, forces from the Afar and Amhara regions may still block them, as has happened in the past. The humanitarian need in Afar and Amhara is also at a crisis point, says Karam.
We should not be underestimating the potential challenge that could come from the Afar regional forces. Because like in Tigray, many people in Amhara and Afar regions are also in need of food aid, and there should be a certain way to deal with this deadlock regardless of the urgent need to respond to the situation in Tigray where access is a critical issue.
Combined, Tigray, Afar and Amhara have 9.4 million people who need humanitarian assistance, according to the UN, which also says the humanitarian situation in Tigray, in particular, is so desperate, people have been eating roots and flowers and plants instead of a normal steady meal. The deadlock continues. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Hike, Ethiopia.
The Office of the United Nations High Commission for Human Rights warns that Mali's new media restrictions reflect a growing intolerance toward freedom of the press in the region. For Muri, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
United Nations human rights officials are expressing deep dismay at Mali's decision Wednesday to permanently suspend Radio France International and France 24 from operating there. They are urging Mali's transitional military authorities to reverse the ban and allow independent media to work freely in the country. The government temporarily suspended the two international broadcasters on March 16th, accusing them of airing false allegations of human rights violations by the Malian army and Russian mercenaries. UN human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shandasani says the current climate of fear in Mali is having a chilling effect on journalists and bloggers.
Where there's a lot of self-censorship, there's a lot of pressure. There have been a number of journalists, local, regional, international, who have come under pressure, licenses revoked, journalists are trying to avoid reporting on sensitive topics so that they don't fall foul of the authorities.
Shamdasani says UN human rights monitors continue to document allegations of serious violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law in many parts of Mali. If anything, she says the prevailing situation in the country demands more, not less, scrutiny. However, she says Mali is not the only country where attacks on freedom of expression and opinion are occurring with increasing frequency and intensity.
However, we are seeing a worrying trend in some of the other countries in West Africa as well. And this applies not only to freedom of expression and then the work of journalists, but also civic space and civil society as a whole. There appears to be a growing intolerance for dissent, unfortunately.
She says journalists all over the world are under threat. Journalists increasingly are being discredited for their reporting, accused of bias, or of spreading misinformation. Shamdasani says governments have many tools they can use to intimidate journalists and prevent the free flow of information. She says governments are increasingly using surveillance to monitor the work of journalists. She adds this makes it more difficult for them to protect their sources, to gather information, report on abuse, and bring perpetrators of crimes to account. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization, WHO, says Africa has faced a surge in the outbreak of vaccine-preventable disease over the past year. The organization says almost 17,500 cases of measles were recorded on the African continent between January and March 2022, an increase of nearly 400% compared with the same period last year. For VOA, Mavis Ochery in Joasso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more on the story.
Disruptions to immunization services and routine health care because of coronavirus pandemic led to the surge in vaccine-preventable diseases. Dr. Maserit Shebisi is the coordinator for the Immunization and Vaccine Development Program for the World Health Organization Office for Africa. She says 13 countries reported new yellow fever outbreaks compared to 9 outbreaks in 2020 and 3 in 2019. She says most of the new yellow fever outbreaks were in West Africa, with a few cases in East Africa. Vaccination campaigns are underway to contain the outbreaks. She says to contain measles, countries aim to get 95% of their children vaccinated with 2 doses. A single dose, Shebisi says, won't provide enough coverage to prevent outbreaks.
Countries have really committed to provide these 2 doses of measles vaccine. However, now, whenever we had such gaps in service delivery, such as the COVID-19 pandemic, the number of children that never got measles has really increased within the time, within this 2-3 year period of time. We have identified the countries that are at risk. We have really reminded our member states to take preventive measures to screen their vaccination status of the children and provide the schedule that they have missed.
She says about 10 million children in Africa have not received any single vaccine, and countries need strategies to get them vaccinated. She says countries such as Central African Republic, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Ethiopia, Nigeria, and South Sudan have reinstated their measles campaigns.
More than 30 countries in the region have really stepped up to provide a catch-up vaccination for those missed children. But we are still reinforcing the message. Where we are is that we cannot leave any single child or individual without being vaccinated. So the call for the member states is to make sure that each and every child due for vaccination receives the vaccine.
She says although progress have been made in curbing world polio outbreaks, one has been confirmed in Malawi. Vaccination campaigns are underway there in neighboring countries like Mozambique, Tanzania, and Zambia. She says the World Health Organization has a regional strategic vaccination plan for countries to ensure that no one is left behind, including a focus on underserved areas such as rural communities. She applauded countries such as Rwanda, Cabo Verde, Mauritius, and the Seychelles for having good vaccination programs, allowing them to nearly eliminate measles outbreaks. Shebisi says some countries successfully integrated other critical immunization campaigns with COVID-19 vaccination efforts. For instance, she said Ghana integrated COVID-19 shots with yellow fever vaccination. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Grasso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music, from African Collection. But first, the Botswana Wildlife Producers Association, a group that focuses on the conservation and management of the country's wildlife, says placing electronic tracking collars on big tusk elephants could help prevent indiscriminate hunts. The idea follows the recent killing of a so-called big tusker during a sanctioned hunt, which sparked outrage among conservationists. For VOA, Nkodisi Duve has details from the Botswana capital, Habaroni.
The association's chief executive, Isaac Theophilus, says while his organization is satisfied that the hunt of bull elephants is being handled properly, tracking some big tusk elephants could help. An electronic elephant collar helps keep track of the animal so that unsanctioned hunts of these animals for their tusks can be prevented.
The hunt, from the point of view of the association, is that it was perfectly legal. We are happy with the size of the trophy that was harvested. And we are glad we still have such big tuskers. And going forward, the association would like to work hand in hand with the government to ensure that we monitor elephant populations out there, go out there, collar a few of the so-called big tuskers, and follow them to ensure that they are not harvested or anything like that.
He contends the criticism of Botswana's decision to reintroduce hunting in 2019 is unjustified. The Southern African country recently opened its annual hunting season, which ends in September.
The issue is that it might have attracted criticisms from certain quarters that do not value the conservation efforts of Botswana. This particular hunt is a very good tusker. We should, as a country, be appreciative that our conservation efforts are bearing fruit. We still have big elephants in the conservation areas, particularly in the concession areas, and maybe within the parks where no hunting is done.
Local professional hunter Randy Mutsumi says hunters always target old bulls with big tusks, which is what their clients demand.
Mostly the hunters are looking for big bulls that are old and are no longer breeding. But if this natural death could have occurred, who would have benefited? No one would have benefited. It would just rot in the bush. But at least now the hunters have shot a big bull, and it has fed more than 700 people. There is money in the government coffers, and the community got employed there. All of those people, they have gained only in one elephant, one big elephant that is no longer breeding.
Conservationist Map Ives says shooting big elephants is what drives the hunting industry.
It is truly an impressive elephant. And the hunting of large tusked elephants is very much at the core of what the hunting industry is selling to its customer base in the United States of America particularly, but also Europe and South America and Australia. And that is what the professional hunting industry is all about, is to find the biggest, largest animal, because they have lists and books of records, and everybody wants to be in that book of records and publish a story about him.
Among critics of the decision to gun down a big tusk elephant is British Conservative Party Member of Parliament Roger Gale. He argues that tourists pay for photographic safaris to see the big tuskers and is opposed to Botswana's decision to reintroduce trophy hunting. But Botswana government spokesperson William Sinseveng says Gale seeks to undermine Botswana's pragmatic and sustainable conservation policy. While elephant populations are declining elsewhere on the continent, Botswana has seen its herd grow to more than 130,000, while most it can support is estimated at 55,000. Kondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas in Puga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's start at the Adizero Road Records event, where on Saturday, Ethiopia's Yomif Kejelsha won the men's 5-kilometer race in 12 minutes, 53 seconds, the fastest debut in history. The Ethiopian beat Kenya's Nicholas Kimeli by 2 seconds, and this was the first road 5-kilometer ever in which two men have broken 13 minutes. The men's 10-kilometer was won by Kibiwot Kandi in 26 minutes and 50 seconds. And even in this event, five men finished inside 27 minutes. Kandi took 1 second off his personal best. Fellow Kenyan Sebastian Sawe, who won the Rome Ostia Half Marathon last month, came second in 56 minutes and 54 seconds. Burundi's Rodrigue Kwizera, winner of this year's World Athletics Cross Country Tour, was third, while world record holder Ronex Kipruto and Ethiopian record holder Tadesi Woku finished fourth and fifth, respectively. In the men's half marathon, Kenyans took the first, second, third, and fourth positions, with Matthew Kimeli coming first, followed by namesake Bernard Kimeli. Alfred Bakach was third, and Amos Kugat was fourth. In the women's events, Ethiopia's Tembere Teferi won the 5-kilometer. Another Ethiopian, Fentaye Belayen, won the 10 kilometers in 30 minutes, 24 seconds. And fellow Ethiopian Tigist Asafa won the women's half marathon in 1 hour, 7 minutes, and 28 seconds. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, has released the Women's Africa Cup of Nations match schedule for the tournament that kicks off on Saturday, July 2, 2022. The first match will be played at Prince Mola Abdallah Sports Complex between hosts Morocco and Burkina Faso, and the two are in Group A alongside Senegal and Uganda. Group B has Cameroon, Zambia, Tunisia, and Togo. Group C has Nigeria, South Africa, Burundi, and Botswana. And the final will be played on July 23rd. Meanwhile, the Congo Association Football Federation, FECOFA, has named the former DRC international Ngoma Kondi Otis as the head coach of its national selection of home-based players, the local Leopards. In a press statement, FECOFA said the appointment takes immediate effect as Ngoma takes over from Florent Ibenge, who led the Leopards to a quarter-final finish at last year's African Nations Championship, CHAN, in Cameroon. The statement added that Ngoma will be assisted by former midfielder Pamphile Mihayo and former goalkeeper Tokala Paulin among the new 21 technical crew members for the next 2 years. Ngoma has coached various clubs in DR Congo, such as Giants, Daring Club, Motema Pembe, and Renaissance of Congo. He was also coach of DRC's under-20 and deputy coach of the senior national team between 2011 and 2012. In European football, Real Madrid won its 35th La Liga title on Saturday after beating Espanyol 4-0. The win also made the Italian coach Carlo Ancelotti the first manager to win titles in each of Europe's top five leagues, that's England, Spain, Germany, Italy, and France. Real have 81 points with 4 games to go and are 17 points ahead of second place Sevilla and 18 points clear of Barcelona, who still have a game to play. Real Madrid will host England's Manchester City in their Champions League semi-final second leg on Wednesday. They lost 4-3 in their first leg. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Owing to the radical development of information technology and the accompanying platforms that have been developed, it has become very difficult to uphold the notion of stubborn facts. We have today accompanying this notion that of alternate facts, misinformation, disinformation, and quite often outright lies. In these circumstances, some spokespersons, pundits, and in fact, even officials are looking around for suitable platforms to pontificate, sometimes emotionally, about geopolitical matters about which they seem to have limited knowledge and understanding. Last week, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, paid visits to Moscow and to Kiev to discuss with their respective leaders about how to search for peace and have a ceasefire, particularly to carry out humanitarian activities. Although he did his best, it has not been possible for the results to be discernible. And owing to that, some pundits have declared that United Nations is a useless organization. They do not differentiate between the political organization of the UN in New York and its specialized agencies like UNESCO, WHO, FAO, and others that are doing magnificent work in favor of mankind. No, it is not true that United Nations is useless. In fact, we need more activity from the organization. The problem with the UN has nothing to do with the Charter. This Charter remains a living document which should help mankind, indeed, to help humanity not to repeat the devastation of two world wars. The main problem with the organization is the member states. The member states, small, medium, or major, have over the years violated the Charter of the United Nations without serious consequences. Member states of the United Nations have crossed borders in the last 17 years without major consequences, except in one case, that of Saddam Hussein when he swallowed Kuwait, and that was repaired. We still have member states that are occupying foreign territories with no consequences. We have member states that are annexing occupied territories without consequences. We still have member states that have created states after violation of territorial integrity, again, without consequences. So it is of no consequence that one should dismiss the United Nations as some are trying to do. The Charter was formulated on the basis of experience gained after the Congress of Vienna in 1815, when the concert of powers was initiated. They gained experience from the Covenant of the League of Nations, which followed the end of the First World War, and created a secretariat with an international civil service. And the Charter of the United Nations incorporates good ideas from these previous efforts. So it is not the organization, it is the member states. In previous commentaries, I have mentioned the serious consequence of the erosion of the character of an independent international civil service of the United Nations, of the difficulty of producing strong, independent Secretary General of the organization. So this is the area where member states should look if they would need to repair the damage that has been done to the organization. It's still useful. It should be needed. And therefore, the focus now should be how best can member states, or some of them, try to bring this terrible war in Ukraine to an end. This is not the time for the blame game. It is not the time to consider more non-military repressive actions to help end the war. Nor is it helpful for such statements that China can dictate to the leader of Russia to end the war, and that would be the end of it. That is too naive. It needs more collective action. And then in doing so, member states, and particularly the major powers, should bear in mind what was once proclaimed by the wise Senator Fulbright, who made a powerful speech in the Senate, which later was developed into a book. And they should look at what he said are the consequences of the arrogance of power. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
I've been needing your love in the pop, 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 pop. Yeah, pop, 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 pop. Girl, show. you're gonna feel alright. I never knew you could do it like that. Like two peas in a product, right? Counting all of my blessings. See, I got you from all that, they make me thank God. Every day you came into my life. Make all of them go, baby, please, baby. Oh, oh, you know I be one colorway. You got me to on, I want some. You got to live on it up, up. Take me up. I wanna hear you say my name. I say, oh, you've been on my mind like all day long. Wind up the morning, oh yeah, whoa, 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 yeah. I've been needing your love in your pop, 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 pop. Yeah, pop, 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 pop. Girl, show ya my secret on me, so, oh, oh, yeah. I've been needing your love in your pop, 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 pop. Yeah, pop, 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 pop.
Wendo angu yesu mkombozi, samona petro unanyacha wenyewe. because of singing in the chosen. Don't worry, okay, so soon as I can get to find a way.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eager, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if while climbing a tree you insist on going beyond the top, the earth will be waiting for you. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.